Good evening and welcome to Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. On the show tonight,
we are building momentum.
The filing deadline has passed. Who's officially in and out in the race for mayor? The holiday shopping season is officially underway, but will inflation dampen downtown Chicago's holiday spirit?
Why do we have it? How does it make Chicagoans safer?
The Chicago Police Department is readying to roll out a new gang database. Community commissioners say not so fast. Iran denounces the United Nations for its investigation into human rights violations during ongoing protests. New research reveals that suicidal ideation among youth was on the rise before the start of the COVID pandemic. The Wirtz family moves ahead with plans for a new project. That and other business news from Cranes. And two Chicago architecture critics team up to ask the question, who is the city for, in their latest book. But first, some of today's top stories. After 54 years in office, 14th Ward Alderman Ed Burke, federally indicted on more than a dozen counts of corruption, is calling it a career. Burke didn't make any grand announcement. Simply, the deadline for the candidates to file their nominating petitions came and went, and Burke's name wasn't on the list. Burke was the longtime chair of the City Council's powerful finance committee and was a vocal part of the opposition bloc to the city's first black mayor, Harold Washington. Two candidates are vying to replace Burke as 14th Ward alderperson. Heather Sharone will have much more on this and notables who did file today coming up. Six people are killed and more than two dozen others injured in shootings across Chicago this weekend. That includes a shooting that left two dead and two others injured early Saturday at a gathering on the far south side. It occurred just after midnight in West Pullman. Two men, ages 34 and 36, were killed. Two others were hospitalized and are in good condition after suffering multiple gunshot wounds. Police say no one is in custody. Chicago and Cook County residents are now at a higher risk of contracting COVID as public health officials raise the warning level from low to medium. That's based on data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Chicago health officials are warning of an imminent surge of COVID-19 as holiday gatherings take place and cold weather brings people indoors. On top of that, Chicago Department of Public Health says hospitals and healthcare providers are also coping with sharp increases in cases of flu and the RSV respiratory virus. And coming up in the program, with holiday shopping underway, a look at downtown Chicago's retail market. That's right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Alexandra and John Nichols, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Some of us like to think of this as the most wonderful time of the year when practically everything is on sale. Seems like retailers start rolling out the Black Friday and Cyber Monday shopping deals earlier and earlier every year. But this year, the third pandemic holiday season will also be impacted by inflation. Joining us now with more are Kimberly Bears, CEO and President of the Magnificent Mile Association, Kiana DeStasi, Chief Marketing and Communications Officer for the Chicago Loop Alliance, Rob Carr, President of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association, and Matt Adams, a principal at Deloitte Consulting, specializing in the retail industry. Thanks to all of you for joining us. Kimberly Bears, let's start with you, please. Many retailers, they did have to shut their doors in 2020 due to COVID. Has Michigan Avenue fully recovered yet?
No, I mean, I wouldn't say any main street, high street in the world has fully recovered. I just came back from London yesterday. It hasn't recovered. New York hasn't recovered. So no area really has recovered, but we're well on the way to recovery. And I think that's the message that we'd like to get out.
What does that look like, being on the way to recovery?
Well, our footfall, pedestrian counts are on the way up. We've surpassed 2021 numbers, so that's a very good sign. 2020, we're not even talking about that anymore, but we've surpassed 21 numbers. Hotel occupancy is up, average daily rates are up, and we're seeing new retailers come onto Michigan Avenue. So all of that is very positive.
Kiana DeStasi, how about the Loop? How are stores there doing?
I would definitely echo what Kimberly has said and also say that during the holiday time is just
one of the most exciting times of the year for downtown. It is definitely a magical time where people are coming down to State Street and the Loop and the Magnificent Mile to shop. And pedestrian levels are, we expect the holiday season this year, especially from what we've seen so far, that we may meet or exceed 2019 levels this year around the holiday season.
It especially looks beautiful,
yes.
I'm sure. Rob Carr, are your members telling you that they are feeling the effects of inflation?
They have been feeling the effects of inflation, particularly when it comes to product acquisition. But I would also note that they're seeing consumers' store count is up, as I believe Kimberly noted. Store count traffic was up noticeably over Thanksgiving, almost 20% over 2021. Inflation has ebbed a little bit for the consumer in terms of lower gas prices. While they're still concerned, they appear to be willing to spend and shop, and that's hopeful for all of us.
Matt Adams, Deloitte did a survey about Chicago holiday shopping. What were some of the main takeaways there?
Yeah, I think the biggest one actually echoes what Rob just said in terms of shoppers before the holiday season were expecting to spend more than they did last year. Up in Chicago, 22% in terms of holiday expenditures. A lot of that is spend on experience. It's not just gifts, but a return to going to restaurants, going to theaters, participating in the festive aspects of the season with family and friends.
And one more question about the survey, Matt. It predicted that holiday spending would decline in the Midwest but increase in Chicago. What's behind that? How do you explain that?
Yeah, I think it goes back to the holiday experiences that I just mentioned, that the experience spending was down significantly over the last couple of years, as you might expect. And this is a big recovery. Again, 46% increase over last year. You didn't see necessarily the same decline in experience spending as you did in the Midwest. And I do think that there is some inflationary concern that people still have, that, for example, the number of gifts is expected to be down year over year across the board, and in Chicago specifically from 15 gifts to 9. So there is some that is a decline based on those inflationary concerns, but people are still planning on prioritizing celebrating with family and friends.
Rob Carr, what does this make you think when you hear, you know, about some of this research and what that means for your members?
Well, I think part of it is, and I don't cast any aspersions here, you see a lot of different surveys that come to different conclusions. You know, for example, Deloitte noted that it could be down over the Midwest, yet we have other studies out of Ohio and Michigan that indicate something in the 4.5% to 5% range. For the Midwest. I would argue that this is why, you know, when you talk about elections, this is why people vote and don't have just surveys, right? We have to see what happens. We've seen a spike in traffic. Our members remain hopeful. The season started earlier. They've seen a lot of good traffic. And I think the marriage that the pandemic really forced upon all of us of online and brick and mortar is really coming home to benefit everyone this holiday season.
Yeah, we definitely see it starting earlier. And earlier every year. Kimberly, or Michigan Avenue retailers, are they finding that they have to make any extra effort to convince consumers to leave their homes and come to the brick and mortar stores?
Well, I think, as Rob said, I think that the onset of the pandemic certainly forced retailers to make sure that their experience was as close to perfection as possible. And on Michigan Avenue, I think that's where we excel. And you know, as Matt was talking about, that experience, nostalgia, people want to be back together. Some of the most iconic architecture, the most iconic experiences are found in the Loop and on Michigan Avenue. And I think that's why our two districts will be, you know, very well served this holiday season.
Kiana, how important are holiday shoppers to a thriving Loop?
This is one of the most important times of the year in the Loop and in downtown Chicago. To echo what everyone has just said, there are experiences in addition to magnificent shopping that you can find on State Street at Macy's and Block 37 and Nordstrom Rack and all these great destinations. You also have two experiential ice skating rinks. There's two different ones in Millennium Park. There's the Tree. Things like the Chris Kindle Market are not just about the things you're buying. It is about that experience you have when you're there. And this year, for the first time ever, we have this brand new State Street Holiday Market, which is all local, independent small businesses and local artists and entrepreneurs, mostly Black, Latinx, and women-owned businesses. And people are feeling, you know, very guilty about all the online shopping we might be doing. And this is a great time to go downtown and have an experience. State Street is lined with lights for the first time ever, from Wacker to Ida B. Wells. There's a whole brand new light. So you just feel magical when you're walking around downtown in our districts. It's just, it's more than just shopping. It's an experience that you've missed having with your friends and family downtown.
Kiana, do you think is there an impact that crime in the downtown area has on shoppers, especially this time of year?
It's definitely the outsized attention that some isolated incidents have on the audience is a challenge. But the fact is, when most people, most experiences, I'm downtown most of the time, and most people's everyday experience are not experiencing that. So it's really a chance. It's crucial and critical that we are all concerned and making sure that our downtown area is safe, because that is crucial to our recovery. And there's a lot of different factors that go into that, and everyone's working hard at it.
Kimberly, is that a concern for the Michigan Avenue shopping destinations?
Well, we know that folks are concerned about safety and security, and that's why we've launched a pilot ambassador program. We have additional off-duty law enforcement. We work extremely closely with our police and other professional responders to make sure that the district is safe and enjoyable for everyone.
Matt, what would you say is the outlook for in-person holiday shopping this year?
Average number of visits to different stores that consumers said that they would undertake is actually up from 4.8 to 6.1. So that in-person traffic continues to gain traction. I think that's a good sign for the city. Shoppers are really dedicated to some of these holiday events and the promotional events. So we saw that more than 50% of shoppers were saying they were going to participate. Hopefully that translated to Michigan Avenue stores and Loop stores this year.
And Matt, are there sort of like pop-up events that are happening as well, or pop-up shopping opportunities? Are those on trend? Are those helping get folks back out?
Yeah, we didn't survey about that, but I can tell you from working with the retailers across the country that pop-ups continue to be something that are a focus. Try to get products in the right place where traffic is. And if foot traffic is up, as we've talked about in the downtown area, then those continue to be something that generate great value for retail organizations.
Rob Carr, I know you're in Springfield right now for the final veto session of the year. What would retailers like to see? What kind of support would you say retailers need from state government?
Well, they're not going to see anything out of veto session necessarily that's going to help them in terms of the holiday season that's already upon us. I think, though, as we look ahead, anything that adds cost, we have to recognize that retail is a narrow margin industry. And it doesn't matter what aspect of it you're talking about, it's a narrow margin industry. So any additional costs that are added have a ripple effect throughout, and it makes it harder and harder to do business and to maintain a presence. So I think we just have to keep that in mind. We have to keep in mind that retail is the largest revenue generator for local governments and the second largest for the state. So as goes the retail sector, so goes the state of Illinois and the services we all enjoy. So I think it's just more of a longer-term view of making sure that it's incumbent on all of us to make sure that the government at all levels is aware of that and applies that to their decision-making processes.
Kiana DeSassi, we're almost out of time, but what would you like to see?
Something that we haven't mentioned also that Chicago has that these other districts that you spoke of doesn't have as much of is the arts and culture. The theater aspect of what is available downtown. I mean, A Christmas Carol at the Goodman Theater that's been there for 45 years opens tonight. There's a number of shows at Broadway in Chicago, The Nutcracker at Joffrey Ballet, at Lyric. There's just so much going on that adds to that experience that's not just about the shopping. So people can go shop and see a show and have dinner and have a great experience.
We've got it all, Chicago.
Yep.
That's all we've got time for. Thanks to Kimberly Bears, Kiana DeSassi, Rob Carr, and Matt Adams. Thanks to all of you. Happy holidays. Happy shopping.
Happy holidays.
Holidays.
And now, Paris, back to you.
Thanks, Brandis. It is official. 9 major candidates will run for Chicago mayor in 2023. That includes incumbent Mayor Lori Lightfoot and Congressman Jesus Chuy Garcia, who filed thousands of signatures today to qualify for the February 28th election. WTTW News reporter Heather Sharon joins us now with a look at where the mayor's race stands now and whether all the candidates who want to be on the ballot will ultimately make it. Heather, good to see you. Before we talk about that, we do have to talk about the big news of the day. Alderman Ed Burke, in office going on 54 years now, decides apparently that he is not going to go for a 55th year and another term. Do we know why? Heather, looks like we're having issues. Heather, can you hear me out there?
Hi. Okay.
There you are.
Burke
okay.
is no longer going to be a member of the city council after May 2023. He faced two major obstacles in running for re-election. One, a 14-count indictment that alleges he used his public office to drum up business for his private law firm. He has pled not guilty, but he also faces a 14th ward that is much different than the one he ran in 2019 with his base chopped off and given to other alder people.
Ed Burke, you know, he's grandfathered into the state's campaign finance law, which has been in effect for about 25 years. He's been there much longer than that, thus the grandfathering in. He's had millions and millions and millions of campaign funds. He can now convert some of that to personal income, can't he?
He can. He has about $9 million in his campaign account. He has already spent $3 million from that account on legal fees, and he is entitled to spend all of that money on legal fees. Now, his trial isn't until 2023. It's not clear how much his defense is going to cost him, but everyone is anticipating a very long, hard-fought trial that will certainly not come cheap.
So if it's already cost $3 million, safe to say it's going to cost several million dollars more, thus having that big campaign fund where he legally can use that money to pay his lawyer's fees. All right, the other news of the day, Lori Lightfoot submits 40,000 signatures early this morning rather than waiting for the finish line at 5 p.m. Explain why that matters.
Well, it means that she will be seventh on the ballot. She will not be last. Had she been in line with Jesus Chuy Garcia, both of them would have been eligible for a lottery to be last on the ballot. Instead, she filed on her own schedule saying it didn't matter to her where she was on the ballot, that people know who she is and they know what she has accomplished in office. But it defies all of the political wisdom, especially in a race that's this crowded. You got to get every little percentage point that you can find.
And it does look like Congressman Jesus Chuy Garcia does want to be last on the ballot because he filed pretty late, right close to that 5 o'clock deadline. Let's listen to what he told reporters today.
I am getting into this race because I think I can be a unifying force in Chicago. I think I have the temperament to bring people together. I have the ability to listen to people, to be collaborative and inclusive.
As is customary, Heather, the candidates all measure how tall their stacks of signatures are. His was a little taller than Lightfoot's. Does that matter to anything?
Well, he certainly hopes it signals that he is a candidate who faced no problem in getting people to support his campaign, that he got these signatures, he said, in 3 weeks and barely broke a sweat. He wanted to signal today that that indicates that he is likely to be in the top two and force the mayor or another candidate into the runoff without breaking a sweat. He signaled, I'm a front runner, take me seriously. And that's what today was about with his stack of petitions emblazoned with a mustache, a symbol we're gonna see a lot of in the next couple of months.
I was just gonna say, we just saw some footage of that mustache emblazoning that stack of petitions. So did either Lightfoot or Garcia talk about what they would do should they emerge victorious at the end?
They did not. Today was a day for, like I said, flexing that political muscle. There were no specifics, even though I asked Lightfoot what this campaign would be about for her in 2023, the way in 2019 she campaigned on an anti-corruption, anti-Ed Burke platform. She said that she would promise to keep working, finish what's undone, and promise to reverse the inequities. Jesus Chuy Garcia had a very similar message, but he promised to do it by bringing people together, a not-so-veiled shot at the very combative incumbent.
And we shouldn't forget another candidate filed to run for mayor today. That is current Alderman Roderick Sawyer. How many petitions did he file, and is he vulnerable to a challenge?
I think he may be vulnerable to a challenge. He declined to tell reporters several times how many signatures he obtained, but one telling sign was that he was able to carry those petitions into the filing center. He did not need a hand truck or a wheelbarrow. It appeared to me that he had maybe about a half as many as the mayor submitted, and that means that his competitors, especially on the crowded progressive side of the aisle, will be looking very carefully at those pages, seeing whether those signatures are valid or whether they can knock him off the ballot and maybe clear a little breathing room in the campaign ahead.
All right, Heather, we're off and running. Thanks very much. Quick note for our viewers, we're having a few technical issues with our lighting, but we are forging ahead. So that's why the strange look right now. And you can read Heather's stories on Alderman Burke and the race for Chicago mayor on our website. It's all at WTTW.com/news. And we're back with more right after this.
Spend Saturday evening with the voices of Chicago. Latino voices at 6 and Black voices at 6:30. See you on Saturdays. One of Chicago's fastest growing companies looks to shed half of its headquarters space in the Loop. A glimmer of hope for suburban renters as rent prices rise. And the Wirtz family takes on a project off the ice. Here to go behind the headlines is Crane Chicago business reporter Danny Ecker. And Danny, another company looking to get rid of some of its downtown office space with more people now working from home. What's the latest with social media management software company Sprout Social?
Yeah, Sprout Social just put about 64,000 square feet of its offices at 131 South Dearborn in the Loop up for sublease. This piles onto already a record amount of office space downtown that's available for sublease. It's actually more than double now than there was at the beginning of the pandemic. Sprout is doing well. Like you said, they're one of the fastest growing companies in Chicago, but they don't expect their workforce to be back in the office on a regular basis. And so they said, well, we could save some money by offloading some space. And we've seen a bunch of new listings like that, obviously, throughout the pandemic, mostly coming from the rise of remote work. But now you also have a recession threat pushing more companies to try to save cash. And that's obviously bad news for landlords, which are already dealing with record high vacancy.
Okay. So in other real estate news, though, suburban apartment rents are up nearly 12%. But there is some good news for renters. What do we know?
Yeah, rents are still at a record high after that jump. It's a continuation of what we've seen throughout the pandemic, with demand for rental units already surpassing pre-pandemic levels. But the rate of growth is starting to slow down. There's an analysis from one apartment appraisal and consulting firm that projected that increases next year should be closer to 4 to 5%. That's closer to a typical annual rent jump. They point to a recession being a big factor in that, potentially a slowdown in the job market. Usually not good for demand for apartments. But you also have rising interest rates, which might make it harder to actually build apartments. So that could keep rents a little bit high. Generally, overall, it's just a good time to own an apartment building in the suburbs. But renters might feel a little relief in 2023.
All right. I'm sure they're looking forward to that. And the Wirtz family, mostly known as owners of the Chicago Blackhawks, they've got a new business venture going back to family roots. Tell us a little bit about their plans to redevelop that farmland in Lake County.
Yeah. So the Wirtz family, they've owned more than 700 acres of farmland just northwest of Mundelein since the 1850s. That's for perspective, a couple decades before the birth of ice hockey itself. It was the original homestead of Rocky Wirtz's great-great-grandfather, Michael Wirtz. It's called Ivanhoe Farms, and the family wants to develop it with as many as 2,000 homes, single-family and apartments. They also want to include retail and restaurants and commercial space. There are other single-family home projects near there that developers are now pursuing, but this will be one of the largest master plan communities in the Chicago area. There's a hearing coming up on December 12th where the village of Mundelein will consider whether to annex the property to support it with infrastructure. So we could see another new arm of the Wirtz business empire.
1850s. That's impressive to have kept it in the family that long. Yeah. Danny Ecker, thanks so much.
All right, Brandis, thanks.
And now, Paris, we toss it back to you.
Brandis, the Chicago Police Department is preparing to debut a revised gang database, but not if community members, including those appointed to the city's new oversight commission, can stop it. Amanda Vinicky joins us now with the latest.
Yeah, Paris, the CPD is seeking public input on its new controversial gang database. And the early feedback from important constituents is unabashedly negative. The Chicago Police Department says that it has good reason for keeping a log of alleged gang members. As it says near the top of the draft policy for the new iteration of the gang database, its purpose is to collect and manage information on criminal enterprises and street gangs to prevent, detect, and investigate criminal activity. But the database has long been reviled by critics, including the city's inspector general's office, which has done audits detailing that the database is ripe with opportunities for errors, contains outdated information, and overwhelmingly lists Black and Latinos. Michael Harrington has long been fighting for police accountability as part of the Rogers Park Community Group Network 49. And he says that inclusion on the list can have harmful consequences.
An existing list that says you are or are not a suspicious person affects people's lives. It affects job opportunities. It affects housing. There are many things that being listed by the police can hurt you.
He says that the CPD's past wrongdoings demonstrate that it is impossible for the police to keep a log and to label who may be in a gang. He says that there simply isn't the trust.
To label 100,000 plus people as members of a gang, there is not the ability to humanely cull that list, to maintain that list as being accurate. And so what we end up having is a huge list of people who are on the suspect list when they never belonged on in the first place.
Harrington is far from the only one with questions. In September, Chicago's CPD Community Oversight Plan truly got underway. Anthony Driver is now the president of the Community Commission for Public Safety and Accountability, and he too has concerns.
It's an open-ended question. It's a question that's still out there. Why do we have it? How does it make Chicagoans safer? How much does it cost? What are the metrics used to define the effectiveness of this? And those are all very large questions I think need to be answered before there's any discussion about whether or not, you know, this database needs to exist and whether it will actually help our police.
He says that commissioners should also consider the CPD's point of view.
No one should just be making policy without taking into account the folks who actually do the work, but risk their lives. But on the other hand, no one should be making policies without talking to community members who pay their paychecks and who also have been harmed by policies like this in the past.
He says that the draft policy has not been properly vetted by the public nor by the commission. He says that he has talked with a lot of people about this proposal and changes coming to the gang database. And he says that so far, not a single person who isn't working for the Chicago Police Department has a positive view and is in support of a gang database, even with those revisions. Now, in light of all of that, he says that he hopes police will at the very least delay bringing out this new gang database, but he may, he says, ask for more.
Is there even a need for a database? I by no means think this is something that's inevitable. I think it's something that needs to be discussed and in a collaborative fashion, and we need to engage the community and work with community groups and residents and officials to figure out whether this is the best use of public dollars and whether this is whether this will still continue to be a discriminatory surveillance tool.
Amanda, this database for years has been controversial. So what exactly is going to be new about it?
Well, Harrington says that the answer is not enough. He says that really, from his point of view, the changes are mostly cosmetic in nature. Now, some things to point out, the policy does not call for automatically notifying somebody when they are put on the gang database. Rather, individuals would have to go to either the Chicago Police Department or the city clerk to learn that information. There's also included in the policy a process to appeal inclusion on the database. Now, there's also criteria for what could put somebody on the database. Either you need to have a recorded conversation in which somebody is admitting to being in a gang, or they have to meet a couple of various stipulations, such as having gang tattoos or displaying symbols for a gang.
Amanda, what's next?
Well, members of the public can weigh in on this draft policy until December 7th, or maybe if they hurry it up, they could do so right now. Have been, of course, dealing with the show, so I haven't checked back. But even as we speak, I imagine that a community oversight meeting is going on, and you had some 200 people signed up to participate, including a couple of dozen who planned to speak to that policy. I want to point out that the CPD did not respond to our request for comment about this, but Driver says that the CPD did commit to a presence at this evening's virtual meeting. He also says that the CPD told him that it does not have a firm timeline for rolling out this new policy. In a previous story about this that was reported by Heather, the CPD did say that it had sought out community input and that it had gone out of the way to make sure that any information included on this new database is accurate, with a statement saying, it is important that this system is built on fair and constitutional policing and that the appropriate amount of time is taken to ensure it is aligned with CPD's commitment to reform. But already you, of course, have, as we were just talking about the mayor's race, opponents of Mayor Lori Lightfoot pouncing, like Jamal Green, who says that instead of a database, the focus needs to be on investing in communities. He says that moving forward with a new gang database is moving toward a police state. Apparently, if you wear the wrong clothes or get the wrong tattoo, the city has the right to put your personal information into an ethereal information system, Green said in a statement. Now, by the way, not just about the policy, but this tension between the Community Oversight Commission and the CPD, while you have the President Driver saying that he's hoping for collaboration with the police department, really, those that are involved in this say that they see it as a first true test of the effectiveness of the commission and how seriously the CPD is going to take it. Really, who calls the shots? Who has the power? Paris?
All right, seems like it's going to be a bumpy road for this new gang database. Amanda, thanks very much. And we're back with more Chicago Tonight right after this.
Do you think there's been sort of a rethinking of how those events happened here in Chicago?
I made a promise to myself in my career that every year I would make a piece of art dedicated to the memory.
Got into a zone of mentor to children. See what we could do to kind of elevate each other. We all we got at this point.
I'm using my past to push forward, to build a movement, to create the world that we all want to see.
The United States men's soccer team faces a crucial match against Iran tomorrow in the World Cup. This comes as the U.S. Soccer Federation posted a picture of the Iranian flag without the emblem representing the ruling regime. It's once again put the spotlight on the brutal crackdown of dissent in that country, where hundreds are feared dead in protests that broke out after the death of a 22-year-old woman who refused to wear a hijab. And here to talk about all these developments are Matteo Farzaneh, professor of Iranian history and the modern Middle East at Northeastern Illinois University, and Iranian activist Dr. Mashid Mir. Thank you both for being back here with Chicago Tonight. Matteo Farzaneh, first remind us what has transpired since September and the initial protests in Iran after the death of Mahsa Amini.
So very briefly, as you said, Mahsa Amini, or Jina Amini, was arrested by the Moro police. She was taken into custody, and somewhere along the line, something had happened to her, and she apparently was hit by a blunt force, and she goes into a coma. She ends up on life support, and she dies a few days later. A very brave journalist, female journalist in Iran, releases the photo first and releases the news, tweets the news, and that's when, so to speak, all the heck breaks loose in Iran, and the protests follow. So,
and they've been going on for the last several months. Mashid Mir, the UN now says it's going to conduct a human rights investigation into the crackdown. Iran saying they're not going to participate in this. What do you believe this investigation is going to uncover?
Well, I'm not sure if the Iran government is not going to have any sort of releasing any sort of information, if there's going to finding anything specific from the government, but we have a lot of footage from the picture. So these days, people are working as journalists, literally trying to document anything that they're seeing, and they're trying to capture all the information. So hopefully with this information that people are capturing, they're going to figure out about what's going on within the prisons and the unhumanitarian conditions that are going on within the prisons, the very repressive actions that the governments are doing these days, killing multiple people without even investigating what's going on and repressing all the protests. So we're keeping hopeful.
And there is an uprising in Iran, but this ruling regime has been in power since the late 70s. Is there any serious threat to toppling them?
There is serious threat, but what I would call not a revolution, but an evolution of dissatisfaction. Every year, Iranian people are rising against the regime, and they want things to fundamentally change. But we also need to remember that this government has been in place for 43 years. Its security apparatus has been perfecting its tools. It's getting a lot of help from North Korea, from China, and from Russia. So in the foreseeable future, to see a absolute 100% change of things, it's very hard to imagine.
And Masjid Mir, we mentioned the protest by the U.S. Soccer Federation, also the Iranian men's soccer team that stood for their national anthem but didn't sing it the first time around. How is this playing into the World Cup match between the U.S. and Iran tomorrow?
So there are a lot of debates about this matter at this point. A lot of people are thinking that the Iranian soccer team are representative of the governments, while a lot of other people are still keep on supporting them as national team of Iran and dividing them from the government system and being supportive of government system. So we're all wondering what's going to happen tomorrow night, considering the fact that the game is going to end around midnight in Iran. And there is always this ceremony because soccer is very important for Iranians. Whenever there's any sort of winning, people usually come out and try to celebrate together in the streets. So we're not sure in the face of any sort of win or loss what's going to be the action afterwards from the people and how the government is going to respond. But we're seeing that governments are very supportive. The Iranian, I'm talking about the Islamic Republic government, being very supportive of the soccer team at this time. And they're trying to advocate, specifically considering the fact that there always have been some sort of conflicts between Iranian governments as they perceive themselves and United States as a symbol of freedom.
And now, Matteo Farzaneh, there are reports that the Iranian government is angry at their soccer team for that protest, standing but not singing the anthem, threatening now to perhaps punish their families. Do you think those are serious threats?
Oh, absolutely. We shouldn't kid ourselves in believing that the Iranian government would allow its players. They are officially representing the Islamic Republic. That is true. But at the same time, soccer, as Masjid is saying, is quite popular. And for the psyche or the mental state of the people, I think they are looking for a win tomorrow. And I did some investigation this morning, calling different people, different journalists inside Iran, to see if people are going to be watching it. The people that I talked to, almost 100% they're going to watch it. Whether or not they're going to come out and celebrate, that's a whole different situation. Things can change if Iran either ties with the U.S. tomorrow or is going to win. Things can go either way.
And Iran would still be alive in the tournament, obviously,
yes,
if they won or tied. If they lost, what do you think the reaction would be?
The reaction would be the same as it has been. Probably they are going to go back, and they are going to face the consequences. I'm talking about the players. And I'm hoping that it's nothing serious.
And, Masjid Mir, the niece of the leader, the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, has warned other governments to cut their ties with Iran. She is against her uncle's rule. Do you think that is the way that the U.S. and Western governments should react, or should they maintain some sort of diplomatic channels?
Well, I'm just going to talk about the people's perspectives because I'm just one of the people. But based on what's going on today, everyone thinks that all the governments are supposed to start isolating these people. And it's not just about Iranian governments. It's about any sort of dictatorship and any sort of repressive governments. As long as other international governments start to acknowledge their presence and start to have diplomacy with them, it's hard to have some sort of change. At least if they have some sort of change in their behaviors or bend for some investigation, open up for a little bit of freedom, there would be some hope for continuing on diplomacy. But till that time, I don't think there's any point for diplomacy, and it's the best for any sort of government to stop and try to make them separate from the rest.
And Matteo Farzaneh, you've said before that the U.S. shouldn't meddle at all because it sort of plays into the propaganda from the ruling regime that all these uprisings are simply caused by the West.
Right. I mean, it would be actually hurting the cause over the long run. And we have to look at all of this very, very realistically. Diplomacy will always win. I don't think anybody supports an invasion or an attack on Iran. At the same time, I think Iranians are between a hard place and a rock right now, not knowing exactly who to ask for help. And I think there is a certain amount of naivete that the Iranians are exhibiting, expecting the Americans to step in. They don't know that Americans don't step in unless there is a huge amount of interest for them. At this moment, I'm afraid there's no interest for them for a change
of
regime.
And there's obviously serious interest in this World Cup match tomorrow. Our thanks to Matteo Farzaneh and Mahshid Mir. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We can go up. All right, we're going to have a story on what new research says about kids and mental health coming up in a second. But first, we're going to be joined by the authors of a prominent new book, thought-provoking book, that is, about the city's storied architecture and how it has or hasn't helped build a more unified and equitable city. That book is called Who is the City For? Architecture, Equity, and Public Realm in Chicago. And joining us now are the authors, Blair Kamen, the Pulitzer Prize-winning former Chicago Tribune architect, and Lee Bay, the architecture critic and editorial board member at the Chicago Sun-Times, who took the photos in the book. Welcome, both of you, to Chicago tonight. You're in the building here, but because of some lighting issues, you're joining us from our offices. We're glad to have you. So how did the two of you come together to create this book? I'll start with you, Lee.
Blair called me up or emailed me after assembling the columns, his columns, and said, would you mind taking the photographs? And it was a great opportunity to kind of go through his columns for the last 10 years and then figuring out a way as a photographer, not as a writer this time, but as a photographer, to sort of see the city as he saw it when he wrote about it and then sort of put a kind of a spin on some of the images.
Right. You're the photographer of the book, and these are Blair's articles over the last 10 years. So, Blair, your first chapter, you're talking about Trump and Obama, two very different presidents, but both sort of with vanity projects in the city, Trump Tower and the Obama Presidential Center. First, share with us some of the correspondence you had with Trump before he was president, when you were going back and forth about his tower and his name on the tower. Blair, I think you need to turn on your mic there. We're getting
How's
there.
That better?
Okay, there you are. There you are. I can hear
okay.
You now.
All right. Sorry about that. The correspondence with Trump initially was pretty cordial on his end. He, in his own words, was sucking up to me because he wanted a good review of his tower. But once I criticized the giant sign that he put on the building, all of a sudden I was no longer an admirable architecture critic. I was, as he put it on the Today Show, a third-rate architectural critic who Trump thought had gotten fired from his job. This was a pretty weird experience for me because it foreshadowed in a way what Trump would do as president, turning journalists into enemies of the people, expressing opinions that really had nothing to do with the subject he was talking about. It really was all about him. So, I mean, when, January 6th happened and he was sitting there in his dining room watching Fox News, watching the insurrection unfold, I wasn't surprised that he didn't do anything because that's Trump. It's all about him. Very, very sad and very strange and weird, really.
He even wished you well. You were undergoing a medical procedure. He writes you a note wishing you well when you wrote a nice review about the building. But then, of course, as you mentioned, everything changed when you criticized the big Trump name. I want to get to an excerpt from the book, a very key excerpt. You write, quote, is this a good city, a just city? Absolutely not. Which prompts a second query. Can those responsible for building the city advance the fortunes of neighborhoods devastated by decades of discrimination, disinvestment, and deindustrialization? On that crucial matter, the jury is still out. So, Blair, how can architecture and planning improve the tale of two cities here in Chicago?
Well, I think we're seeing an attempt to do that right now by Mayor Lightfoot's administration. One of her signature programs, Invest Southwest, has amassed $2.2 billion in private and public investment in order to rebuild the commercial corridors of 10 community areas on the south and west sides. That's a very different strategy than the public investment that went into building the failed public housing projects like Cabrini Green and the Robert Taylor homes. The problem for Lightfoot is that these developments of hers in Invest Southwest are on paper right now. Construction hasn't started yet, but they do look good on paper, Paris. They're very intelligently assembled plans. They use good architects. They have a nice mix of modern and historic buildings. They mix uses to try to make lively and safe streets. So there's a lot of promise there. And, you know, I think that her planning commissioner, Maurice Cox, really does deserve credit for pushing things forward in this very constructive way.
Right. So there's some projects in Austin, in Auburn, Gresham, Lee Bay, a crucial potential public space or a space that has been a public space in the past, has been the bottom floor of the James R. Thompson Center. Now Google is purchasing it. Do you have high hopes here that Google can repurpose that space into a public space?
You know, they certainly should, but the jury is still out. And I think that, the town's remaining architecture critic, which is me, will certainly be pushing for that. I mean, the beauty of saving that building, in addition to saving its historic exterior, is preserving that space on the inside. That's really where the building zooms. And, the question is whether that'll be preserved. And in some way, we're hoping, yes, it should be. How do you do that in the light of where we are security-wise? You know, before 9/11, before all the madness, you could walk into any lobby of any building in Chicago and look around. Now you can't do it as much. So is this building going to be locked down, or is it going to be open? If it's going to be open, how is it going to be open? All those are questions that have to be answered, but I think there's a point of view, yes, it should be open, that could be expressed.
And we know that you and others will keep the pressure on Google to make that happen. Blair, you write in the book about how, you know, projects on the south and west side aren't just beneficial for those neighborhoods, but for the entire city. For instance, the extension of the Red Line down to 130th. You've written a couple columns on that. But right now, older people are still not on board with providing any city funding for it. So what does that tell you about the political will here to engage in projects that close the gap between the haves and the have-nots?
Well, I think that in some cases, the aldermen are taking a very short-sighted and ultimately disingenuous perspective. They didn't have the same problem with using TIF funds to fund the Purple and Red Line modernization on the north side. But now, all of a sudden, it's the south side, and they've got some problems with it. I just find that despicable, honestly. I think that this is a huge project. As Lee has written in the Sun-Times, it's one of the most important urban design projects on the city's plate right now. It has all these potential benefits, not only for eliminating the transit desert on the far south side, but increasing the tax base, improving air pollution problems, making the labor pool better for downtown employers. I mean, there are just enormous benefits that would accrue to the whole city. So the argument of the aldermen is just utterly baseless, in my view. And it's again, this gets to the core issue of the book. Who is the city for? Who gets what? Who gets treated fairly and who doesn't? And, if this project doesn't go forward because of aldermanic short-sightedness, it will be a tragedy and a travesty for the city of Chicago.
All right. Well, it's great to see both of you come together and write this book. Two great minds on architecture, and we appreciate you being here. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paris. Great to be here.
And again, the book is called Who is the City For? Architecture, Equity, and the Public Realm in Chicago. You can read an excerpt on our website. And there's more Chicago Tonight just ahead, so please stick around.
Thoughts of suicide have been on the rise for children and teens even before the pandemic set in. Researchers at Northwestern School of Medicine and Lurie Children's Hospital say emergency rooms in Illinois experienced a spike in kids ages 5 to 19 coming in with suicidal thoughts or ideation in the fall of 2019, and then another surge during the pandemic. This research is the latest in a round of warnings of mental health crisis in children across the country. Joining us now is Dr. Audrey Brewer, instructor of pediatrics at Northwestern University School of Medicine and a pediatrician at Lurie Children's Hospital. Dr. Brewer, thank you for joining us. So specifically, your research shows ER visits relating to suicide thoughts spiked in the fall of 2019. That is before COVID, as we know, increasing 59% between the year 2016-2017 and 2019-2021. What does this research tell you?
Yes, thank you so much for having me. So basically, I mean, you said it, you know, we were seeing mental health concerns, specifically in this study related to suicidal ideation related emergency department visits among youth throughout the state of Illinois before the pandemic. So I know a lot of people talked about how mental health concerns was a big thing and it started to increase during the pandemic. But we know from this study that there were a lot of kids who were experiencing suicidal ideation concerns before the pandemic.
And any thoughts on what might be some of the reasons for this?
That's a great question. I think at Lurie Children's and Northwestern and probably across the country, lots of pediatricians and researchers and psychiatrists are definitely concerned and trying to figure out what are some of the reasons for why we're seeing more kids experiencing suicidal ideation related visits in the emergency department. I mean, there's so many different factors that could be potentially related. I know a lot of people have talked about the influence of social media, and that's possible, but there are other things.
And Dr. Brewer, sorry, I'm not sure if you can hear me. I think we may have lost your audio there, so I don't know if it's a Zoom function. But I want to follow up with another question, and then, of course, we can come back to that if our... Okay, there you are. Now I've got you. Sorry. So you were talking about some of the factors beyond social media.
Yes, thank you so much. So other factors that could potentially be causing these kids to, you know, have these thoughts are definitely related to bullying. There could be other problems in school that kids are experiencing, potentially problems at home. So we think about social influencers of health or social indicators of health that definitely influence our health in general and definitely will influence our mental health.
So there's also been, you know, some additional research. There's yours, and yours adds to a body of research that we've had over the last few years, or the last year or so, actually, about the role of the pandemic on children's mental health. You know, as a professional, what are you worried about as far as the future goes? What's keeping you up?
I mean, that's a great question. I think one of my biggest concerns is we talk a lot about these numbers, but what are we doing to really address these concerns among our youth? And I really do think it's important to really think about not only the youth, but also their caregivers, their loved ones who are taking care of them on a daily basis. And so I really feel like I'm hopeful, you know, that we can start really problem solving and to develop policies that will really help to strengthen families, to help our youth in different settings, whether it's in the school system or in different community types of resources that are available to them to really help them to, you know, be resilient, to thrive.
Your research also found that hospitalizations increased by 57% in that same time frame that you studied. And you just mentioned, you know, parents, caregivers, teachers. How can those adults in a young person's life help a kid or a teen who might be struggling with suicidal ideation?
First is listening, you know, taking time to really hear what are some of the concerns kids have and taking it seriously and really starting to like normalize these mental health concerns. I know it can be uncomfortable conversations, but we need to start having more of these uncomfortable conversations. But then also parents and loved ones and caregivers can seek out additional support and help through talking with their child's pediatrician. That's the first place to start.
And Dr. Brewer, we've got about 30 seconds left. What more research would you like to see your colleagues produce so that we know more about what to do next?
So I definitely think it's important to look more at different experiences that racial and ethnic backgrounds, different groups of people are experiencing, because there may be different cultural factors that have influenced kids' mental health, families' mental health in general. So that's where I'm thinking we really need to start focusing in on and really better understanding what are these social factors that are influencing mental health outcomes among our youth.
That's important research that you and hopefully your colleagues will be doing going forward. I'm sure they will. Dr. Audrey Brewer, that's where we'll have to leave it. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we're back to wrap things up right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Alexandra and John Nichols, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
And that is our show for this Monday night. Don't forget to stay connected with us by signing up for our daily briefing. You can also get Chicago Tonight streamed on Facebook, YouTube, and our website, WTTW.com/news.
Special thanks to our crew for getting us through some of these technical difficulties. And you can also get the show via podcast and the PBS video app. And please join us tomorrow night live at 7.
Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman.
And I'm Paris Schutz. Thanks so much for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that supports free educational initiatives in the legal profession.